woman. He had to calc on his life, he discovered electricity.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. I see they took down the tape of the whole proceeding.
Well,
the UN
Mayfair.
Oh, that's right.
Are you the trust dog? Are you married to a
club? I'm a Mrs. Ross
family. Oh, 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 they are the oldest.
Oh, you married to a son.
A lot of people think I'm a daughter. But
well, you look like you'll be a royal descendant.
Well, I have to fess up, I am.
Always, grandmother always says her grandfathers were chiefs.
Yes. You know,
all chiefs?
No, they weren't all chiefs. My father's father was a chief.
Oh, she's talking about me.
Oh, yes, I know she is. Well, your father's father was a chief.
Hers was.
Yes, her father's father. It was really, it should have been your grandmother, wasn't it, Cecilia? But the way the Indians do, when a man marries a woman that would have had the chief's place, he becomes chief.
Yeah.
And her mother was a Burnett, you know, Pete Burnett's daughter.
Uh-huh. Pete Burnett. Mm-hmm. I've seen Pete Burnett years ago.
Oh, yes, long time ago. He lives up on the Canadian border.
Yes, I've seen Pete Burnett.
Yes. He was the oldest brother of those Bill Burnett, and, you know.
Yes, I know.
That's
now. Was it nice this morning when you got up, warm enough here?
I didn't sleep here yet. I don't sleep there yet, but I'm moving in. I've got over at her house.
You know. Oh, yes.
It's warm enough because he likes that oil heater now.
Oh, yes.
Got that connected up.
Mm-hmm.
But, the other one, the cooking stove that's there now is a kerosene stove. That gives quite a lot of heat. But after he gets the walls painted and get my furniture all in, you know, it'll be better, and then I'll sleep there. I'm just going to use those two rooms.
Oh, that's fine.
Because, you know, the doctor tells me not to sweep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That the motion of the sweep is not supposed to be good.
Who's that?
My grandson.
Sure it does. Oh, that's it. Were you born in Red Lake?
No, I was born in Wisconsin.
Oh.
I'm not Chippewa, if the truth must be known.
That's right. I remember. I heard you speak at the university.
Yes, that's right. And then, I married a Chippewa. My husband was a Chippewa. And just think of it, it's 50 years since I came to Minnesota.
Well, how did the, you say you're an Algonquin or an Iroquois?
Iroquois.
How did they come to Oneida? How did you get it to Wisconsin and that?
Well, the Iroquois lived in New York State.
Oh.
And the government wanted some of that territory where they lived, around Schenectady and Oneida. And so they bargained with the chiefs to get the land.
Sitting here, I have my recorder right here.
Because my grandfather was a chief, he was one that bargained for the transportation. And
what year was this?
In 1832.
32.
Uh-huh.
After the 1812 war.
Yes.
Is the bargaining.
And
the revolution.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And then the war of 1812.
It was after that. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather moved his bands, and
her that was a treaty, grandmother.
Of course, you know, the government, the federal government and the state government made treaties with the Indians at that time. And of course, the federal government made this treaty with the Oneidas that wherever they want to go, they would transport them free of charge. So the government paid all expenses, they moved the bands to Wisconsin. Later, about 40 years later, when the white men wanted again our land in Wisconsin, the government offered us a big territory, nearly half of Kansas, the state of Kansas, if we'd move on down there and let the white men live where we were here. But we didn't go. Yeah, the chiefs wouldn't agree to moving again.
In Wisconsin, near Green Bay and Sturgeon Bay there, where they have all the cherries.
Yeah. They want you to move down to that barren desert of Kansas.
Yes, that prairie, sandy
prairie. Oh, yeah.
But they didn't accept that offer. So there's a good part of Oneidas left in New York that didn't want to move, but our part came to Wisconsin. And then, of course, before that, right after the Revolution, most of the Oneidas fought on George Washington's side. And so after the war, they could stay there, but a few that had been persuaded, and the Mohawks that fought on the English side, they were offered territory on the Canadian side, and they went. So this.
Why do you laugh?
Well, they fought on George Washington's side.
the rebel. But they figured that he had the right cause to fight for.
Well, they were already against the English. Yes. The English had already.
Yeah, the English was already taking lands from them.
Sure.
And so they were glad. And then this is the other thing I wanted to tell them this morning, but I didn't. Was the fact that there was Indians that met the pilgrims at
Plymouth
Rock, where Chippewas was. You know them as Algonquins. Yeah. The histories all tell you. Every history you get tells you they were Algonquin Indians. All right, they talked the Chippewa language.
They did the same language.
The same language. Now, you know, it's too bad I didn't write everything that my husband used to tell me. The word Massachusetts is, that name is a Chippewa name, but it's, I think it's four words. But I can't remember what it is.
Well, the Chippewa then is an Algonquin.
Sure.
Yeah, the Algonquins are Chippewas.
The Algonquin Nation.
Yeah. Vice versa.
They're not Chippewas, they are Ojibways. But the Englishman couldn't say it Ojibwe, he said Chippewa. And
does that have another meaning also, or is it's
just a mispronunciation.
It's a grammatical error.
It's a mispronunciation of the Chippewa word, Ojibwe. The word is Ojibwe. And Ojibwe is translated, it pertains to that puckered seam here on the moccasin, which is the national style of shoes, that footwear that the Ojibwe's had.
Did anybody ever trace the history of Hiawatha? Now that must have some relationship to the Algonquin source of Hiawatha.
Ojibwe's, not Algonquin, Ojibwe's.
Ojibwe's. From the east, and that legend is so similar to the legend here then.
It's the legend from here. Mrs. Schoolcraft was a Chippewa woman from Red Lake. She was an Ojibwe woman. And she went east with her husband, and she is the woman that told those things to Longfellow. Longfellow never was out of Massachusetts, you know.
That's true. But she was Flat Mouth. Wasn't she Ruth Flat Mouth?
No.
Wasn't she Flat Mouth's daughter that married Schoolcraft?
No, it wasn't. Flat Mouths were Onigam, lead slave. Holy smoke. Sayers at Red Lake are descendants. But I can't remember their name. I just can't.
Flat Mouth was one of them, but that wasn't him.
Well, he was a lead slaker.
A Leech Laker,
yes,
was he?
Yes, he was a Leech Laker. There were more Leech Lakers on that commission than any other.
Now, was that your family then that came to Wisconsin from the Oneida?
No, that's Chippewa. That's Minnesota.
But this family, she married a Chippewa.
Yes, that's...
But not from Flat Mouth.
No.
No, but I was going back to coming from the east. You came to, your family came to Wisconsin.
My grandfather's family. And then my father and mother were raised in Wisconsin, and that's where I was born. And then after I got through school and was teaching school, I taught first in Canada, and then when I came home, I thought the salaries were so much bigger over here than they were up there in Canada, that I wanted to teach over here. So I applied for a position, and the civil service sent me to Palm Springs, Minnesota, to teach in a boarding school there. So that was in 1905, and I came up to Minnesota then. And so I didn't know that when I got among the Chippewas that there would be a man there laying trap for me and I'd get caught.
That ended your teaching career.
It ended my teaching for a time, yes.
That was a shame too. I bet you'd have made a marvelous teacher.
Well, I don't know.
I mean, you are a marvelous teacher.
I might have been more or less. Of course, my work was so different, you know, and any work done there could be marvelous because it was under more difficulties than ordinary teaching. And that's how I got to Minnesota, and that's how I became practical at Chippewa. I was 11 years old when I went away from home to school. And I knew next to nothing. I didn't even know I was Indian. After I got to school at Hampton, there was another girl there that was about a year older than I was. She didn't know she was Indian. Yeah, we knew we were Oneidas, but we didn't know that it was Indian.
Was that Virginia?
Yes, Hampton, Virginia. Yeah. And then, you know, one day there were visitors there, and a lady was talking to us, and our matron said to us, these Indian girls are from Wisconsin. And oh, I was so offended because I thought Indians were some wild people from somewhere, so I didn't know just where.
Sure.
Uh-huh. I didn't know you were born
there. No.
Isn't that
so I wrote home to my father that night. We both cried. We felt so bad to think that they thought we were Indians because we were Oneidas. And so I wrote home to my father and told him that they were calling us Indians. He had to write and tell me I was.
Isn't that strange? What did your husband do? What was he?
Well, after he finished school, he used to work in a Catholic sisters' home orphanage in North Dakota, and also he was an orchestra leader there in town.
Oh, he's a musician.
He was quite a musician. And later he came home to Minnesota, and then he worked at the boarding school where I was sent by the civil service.
That's where the trap was set.
And that's where that trap little guy fell into.
She stumbled with a food tray and he rescued her.
Well, you know the way it was. There weren't many people that could play the piano. There was these boys, they had their instruments and they'd play together, but there was the piano part to some of their music that nobody could play. And there was only one piano in the whole community. This was kind of on the outskirts of civilization. And so when I got there, I could play some.
Did you play the piano?
So I played the piano parts for some of their orchestra music. And that's how I met my husband.
Well, that's an ideal romance.
So, and it was so funny, 2 years afterwards when I was transferred to be, you know, I chummed with a girl from Kansas that was the other teacher. And we chummed together. And she was madly in love with this man, you know, and she would just follow him up and she couldn't leave him alone. And I thought it was a really cute affair. And she and I chummed, and she'd tell me what he'd say and what she said and all kinds of things. And I was very much interested. And he'd take us to all kinds of places, you know, when he was off duty. And he had a top buggy and a horse there. There were no automobiles, you know.
Yeah, he was baiting his trap.
Yeah, and so then he'd take us in that top buggy, you know, and we'd go places. And I always thought I was the third person. But when I was transferred, the superintendent told him to take me to Park Rapids. to the nearest railroad station. And
how many miles was that, Greg?
22.
In a horse and buggy?
No, we had the school.
Right?
It was, we had the school rig and a team of horses.
Oh, a team.
Uh-huh. And anyway, we went. And
still took a long time.
Yeah, it still took a long time.
Yeah, and I thought it was on the way to Park Rapids. Then he told me that it was me he was taking around. It wasn't Clarissa.
I'm gonna tell it all now.
And then when we got to Park Rapids, he says, "You know, you play that orchestra music awfully well." He said, "I wish you could be my accompanist all the rest of our lives." Oh, I never knew that it was a proposal.
You thought you were really going to play the piano.
I thought it was going to be a little piano. So. But that's the way, and then I went to Bina and taught school there.
Where?
Up here at Bina. Right, they used to. There was little boarding school, the next town from here, and that's where I went to. I got a great big promotion, $5 a month raise, and so I rushed up there.
You know what you could do with a bad heart? You know, you could sit down and write your life history. That's that you could do that, couldn't she? Mm-hmm. I mean, she can't plant a garden, but why don't you do that?
Well,
you're a natural storyteller, you know, just tell it.
You know, I can't write like it, the way I talk. I can talk like that, but I can't write it.
Mm-hmm. Not anymore.
Did I ever?
Yes, you did.
Oh.
Well, we'll have to get you a tape recorder, and every day you just talk into it. That would be all you have to do is sit down and talk.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Turn your heart on, grandmother.
Yeah, that would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
When you get your electricity, why?
Yeah, Monday or Tuesday, he said he would come back. You see, they're from Bemidji, the power company.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he'd be back Monday or Tuesday.
He's the funniest person, you know. He isn't very nice for a businessman.
I don't think he is either.
Yeah,
he
so
doesn't try to... doesn't want to make you feel that he's accommodating
you.
Mm-hmm. It sounds just like he's doing me such a big favor to say that he would come.
Before we leave the Algonquin, do you know anything about the history that they had the United Nations under Hiawatha that I was just reading recently?
Oh.
That was a wonderful history that ought to be told.
Yes.
Do you know anything about that?
About the United Nations?
Yeah, that they had, this is where Hiawatha came in. And this United
she
Nations.
She means the five nations.
The five nations.
I know a little. All right, they met at Pipestone.
The Chickasaws were one of those numbers, and they're practically unheard of now.
Yes, you see,
I just read a book that was at the library that Jefferson actually took part of the Constitution from this five nation. Thomas Jefferson.
That's a confusion.
No, according to this book,
that's a confusion.
That he studied the Algonquin.
No.
Constitution of the Five Nations?
No, it's
no.
The Iroquois.
The Iroquois.
The Iroquois five tribes.
Oh, yes, I'm getting
that's
well,
where
that
the
would be
uh-huh.
because
the Iroquois.
The Indians were here many years before those guys ever come over here.
I heard they were.
That
heard
could
of that.
Be.
Yes. Jefferson didn't get acquainted much with Algonquin Indians.
No, I'm getting it mixed up.
Yeah,
I mean the
it's a confusion.
I mean the Iroquois.
Yeah, he made friends with the Iroquois people. That's the Mohawks, Cayugas, Oneidas. Tuscarora. And Senecas. The Tuscarolas were added later. They were a Canadian, but they were of the same people.
The Five Nations.
Yes, same people as the Five Nations. That is, their language, you know, was very similar to the languages of these Five Nations. But it's the Iroquois Five Nations that Jefferson was acquainted with. That's where he took some things and put into the Constitution.
On uniting nations.
According to that. But you see, the Iroquois, they had no written law. They had no written constitution. It was all passed on from generation to generation by word of mouth. That's the way.
Nevertheless, they had law.
Nevertheless, they had law, very definite. The Ojibwe was the same way. I wish I could have retained. I haven't got them all. I have one or two of those speeches I've written, where I've explained all that, you know, but I haven't got.
You haven't got them?
I don't know.
You don't have a copy of
them? I don't have any copies of it. I have some, but you see, after my husband died, I packed up my things and I went different places. And I had a lot of things in the shed that was broken into, and a lot of things taken. And among the things that were missing was stuff I had written, so.
Well, if you would like to talk it down, I'd be glad to come up and then I'll type it for you.
That's very wonderful.
I would certainly think it would be a historical contribution to do that.
I have a friend in Chicago who has offered to do the same.
The dad and the mother at home.
Here comes Mr. Whalen.
She brought him to the hospital.
Well, I don't know.
She's coming here?
It's just like I would like to, but I got confused. Now this morning when I told the people that the Chippewas had given many contributions to the nation, I couldn't for the moment think.
But think what it would be if you realize that this was connected with our Constitution, with Jefferson.
That's right.
You know, that they really made the foundation of our Constitution.
Well, it wasn't exactly the real foundation, but there
it was connected with it.
Yes, it was connected with it.
With the struggles in Europe.
They were excerpts, you know, in the Constitution from that.
That's a tremendous thing.
He used to go to their councils and their smoking times.
Well, it was a great thing that he understood that, the Jefferson.
Well, you see, the Iroquois were among the first people that that got acquainted with the white people, and they learned to talk, and so they could get across to him what was saying.
He might be ill. He might want to lie down or something.
No, difficult. We should have done that first. Do you want me still to say something?
Yeah, you're all going on here, you know.
All this time? What have I said?
We'll pay him back after.
Well, I would love to do that sometime.
You girls don't run away.
Where are you going?
Just going outside. I don't exactly know what to say now. I was just now going to begin.
Well, just ask her. Maybe you can interview her.
I'd like to have you say something what you did this morning about how your feeling about the Indian problem, because I think that's something that should be.
Well, we were gathered together to discuss the Indian problem, which is not so very old after all, and not so serious, but what it can be mostly taken care of. The fact that, according to Karl Rowan, we have these Indians who are destitute and poor and in very poor condition. It's true we have them, just like, as I said, all other nations have such classes. Every nation has classes. No nation is all one class. Every nation has the more superior classes, more intelligent, smarter people, and less down to the poorer classes, destitute classes, that we all have. We've always had them. Solomon, King Solomon had them. King David had them. And they'll always have them. The Bible says so. You'll always have the poor with you. So it's a good thing for us to have them, because it's the only way that we won't forget charity. And so I admit we have this class. And the fact that these people that meet together like this each year shows that there's a very generous strand throughout the nation, that are people that are, that, what shall I say, they're
charitable.
They are charitable. Charitable is the word I wanted to say. And that they wish to see us in a better condition. This condition wouldn't have been as extensive if it wasn't for the methods that the government had used with us. The government put us on reservations, separating us from other people. They put us in boarding schools, separate from other children. And so we didn't know the white people, and they didn't know us. And we're just, this, what we're going through, people say we are, the Indians are going through a transition period. So are all the other nationalities in the United States. The white people are going through a transition period. You know very well you don't live like your grandmothers and your parents did. You have conveniences and you have manners and ways of doing things that your parents didn't know anything about. None of us. We're all, everybody's living in a transition period. And in this transition period, we are getting acquainted with each other. And little by little, we are becoming more alike. We are the good copies. We're, the white people are not copying us as much as we are copying them. As I say, these Indians, that I'm always proud of this fact, that my people, the Indian people, are getting to the top range of the white man's civilization in these 200 years. And this is civilization that the white man has taken thousands of years to reach. Of course, the white man is advancing yet. He's still reaching farther ahead. And we're trailing right behind. And there's some of us that are keeping pretty close up to the white men now. But we still have this poor class that needs care. As I say, we'll always have them. But now we have many competent Indians in the cities. In Detroit, Michigan, Pontiac, Michigan, in Chicago, in the Twin Cities, New York, all the big cities in the West, San Francisco, and San Diego, and Seattle, and Portland. We have Indians right from Cache Lake and around here that have gone to all those places. Why have they gone? Because into those communities they found places where they can fit into the community life and make for themselves a happy, prosperous, satisfactory living. That's why they're over there. And now, like I told you there this morning, I have a son, my younger son is in Spain. Why? Because he's in the Navy serving the nation. That's where he fits. He's been trained for it and he fits there. So this is part of the work of his life. He's over there now and that's where he fits. And he's making a good living and a good career. And my other son is out in San Francisco because over there he found a place in that community where he could fit in his life and all his activities into and fit right. And that's where he's happy and satisfied and comfortable and everything going right. And my oldest son is here in the same town because here he was among the first of those boys that could fit into some industrial work around here. And so that's the way. We have a large percentage of the tribe that are away from the reservation and have fitted themselves into communities and into places where life is happy and satisfactory.
What you said about everybody being human, that was a great statement.
Yes.
I mean,
yes. I said, God made the Indian just like he made Adam and all the white people. I don't know that he made the Indian in the Garden of Eden, but I do know that God made them. And they are human. God had only one pattern, and he made all humans in that pattern. And so that far we're all alike. And given the same opportunities, the same start opportunities, the same training and recognition, the Indian will advance just as far as any other human being in any other nationality. We have them. You saw Mr. Smith. You saw our county attorney. We have a number of attorneys. And yes, and no end of nurses, stenographers, and our people that have gone to school, our home. You know them, and you know many others like them that are competent and wonderful housekeepers. You have nobody in the white race that are any better housekeepers than they are. And given the same chances, they'll go as far as anybody.
Well, I think we have a great deal to learn from the Indian, too. I like Carl Rowan's saying that, too.
Yes. And there is this thing, too, you know, that the Indians have made contributions to the life of the Caucasian nationalities here. We have a lot of foods that the Indians have had that the white people didn't have when they came here, like kinds of beans, and there's corn, and there's squash, there's cranberries, and there's wild fruits that they didn't have when they were in Europe. And
tobacco.
What's that?
Tobacco.
And there's tobacco, of course, among the most important, because tobacco is sacred in among the Indian people. And then there's Indian medicines, lots of Indian medicines that have been used up by the druggists and are on the market now under white man's names. And you don't know you're using Indian medicine lots of times. So those are contributions that the Indians have made, and I think is very creditable.
There's a greater one too, is of their imagination, of their relationship to the natural world. I mean,
The Indian, in all the life of the Indian, they were very close to nature. Mm-hmm. And the Indian can tell you of things about nature that it takes college graduates to know among white people. Mm-hmm. And because they just have lived close to it and have become acquainted.
But all was related. That's
so
what I think.
Tradition connects up the human being with nature, the life in nature, all through. And some of that is wonderful stories. And the religion of the Indian people was so practical that they lived their religion. They didn't go to church Sundays. They lived every day their religion. And then among the things that I like, I always appreciate the fact that white people have had regard for the Indian languages and named rivers, places, states, towns, and industries and other things. Mm. They've given them Chippewa names. And they haven't given Norwegian names and German names so very much. They have some, but nothing like the extent of the Indian names throughout the whole country.
Did the Indian help to make the alphabet too?
No. The Cherokee Indians had a sort of an alphabet, and scholastically, I guess they were the most advanced, because they had things written down which that other tribes didn't have.
Oh, they did have it.
Yes, they had a kind of an alphabet, something similar to what you know. Mm. But the Chippewas didn't have a written language. They had a few signs, but nothing extensive.
They didn't need it.
No, they didn't. You know, each community was a complete community, complete life in itself. And each community had its own government and its own activities separate from all the other communities. And the word of the chief in each community was final. And he just said it should be this way, that should be this way, something else some other way, and it was that way.
They had no cultural connection with each other, or did they meet sometimes?
There were sometimes this group and that group friendly between themselves, but mostly they left each other pretty well alone. Mm-hmm. There was intermarriage between the different groups and all that. But I like the idea that the white man has copied lots of Indian, the Boy Scouts and these youth groups have copied Indian life a whole lot. And I always say it's a joke on the United States government. They, 65 years ago, after the Civil War, the government put up schools here and there to teach, to civilize the Indians. And they sent employees out here and gathered up the young people and took them far away and started to teach them the white man's way of living. And they mustn't do anything that's Indian. It must be all white man's way. And the Indians learned those ways, and then after they learned it, they sent them home back to the reservation to conditions that was absolutely Indian and nothing.
Do you think that there's any way that the Indian can preserve his identity and at the same time follow this white man's path that you say?
Not preserve completely his identity,
but some of
there
it
can be excerpts, some of it from be retained. Mm-hmm. You don't have to give everything up.
What would you say to the younger generation now of youth, both Indian and white? How can we make it better and avoid some of these?
Well, I tell you, the social trends of the younger generation at this time, it's alarming, because do you realize that it is becoming necessary to build more corrective institutions?
For everyone. I mean, this is not just an Indian.
They're not building them for the Indians. No, don't make a mistake. They're not building those houses of corrections for the Indians. They're building them for the white people. They haven't got any nationality in mind. But I will say there has never been penitentiaries, jails, or any other institutions of corrections built for Indians. That's something they have had. There has never been a sheriff appointed just for Indians. They've been appointed for communities. So that much is, I think, much credit to Indian people.
Do you think we're on a path of brotherhood, that we can all move together again instead of this?
It's the one desirable way of advancing. I think that by becoming more friendly, affiliated with each other, we will make better and quicker and more complete progress and more permanent progress. But any battling between the different nationalities retards progress.
Well, with this atom bomb, we have to be brothers whether we want to or not, actually, don't we?
Yes.
And we will all be destroyed.
Yes, we'll all be destroyed, that's right. Of course, that isn't going to be very close to us at any time.
Well, not to you maybe, but to her, my grandchildren, and your grandchildren.
No, I don't think it... The Indian race is being assimilated so fast that we're not as separate as your people think. It's only a small group, a small class, that is still a separate group from the white population of the country.
But I would like to see all minority groups keep their culture while at the same time moving in to the,
well,
to the whole, I mean, so they wouldn't be lost. I mean, the Negro problem, the Jewish problem, they don't want to lose the thing they have to contribute.
No, they don't want to lose at all, but they're bound to lose some of it. You can't make progress and retain all. You've got to leave some behind. Some of it just doesn't fit your life after a while. You've got to leave some of it behind, but there's lots that should be retained. But now look at the Swedish people come from Sweden to America. Do they retain their ancestral traditions?
They don't. To lose it is...
In the second generation, those same Swedes, get the children of those immigrants don't know a word of Swedish language. Well, that's the way it gets with all the people.
I don't believe it should, though. It's
Well, it may be a mistake, but it gets that way. It's a natural trend.
Recently stated that the Soviet Union expects in the next few years to catch up with the United States in the production of milk, butter, and meat. American experts say this is an unrealistic target, especially with regard to livestock, the increase of more than three times in livestock. How do you plan to do it?
Unfortunately, not only Americans, but the peoples of other countries, and even people who call themselves scientists, had certain doubts when Lenin and the working class of the Soviet Union took power and called upon the peasantry to support the Soviet power. All these people thought that the Soviet power wouldn't last more than a month. And only one of your countrymen, John Reed, who wrote the book 10 Days Who Shook the World, he had the foresight to say that a new epoch had arrived. I'm saying this to show how the October Revolution was received in America and in the West in general. Our measures to reorganize our backward agriculture, when we started our five-year plans, no one believed in them and considered us to indulge in fantasies. But 40 years have now gone by since the October Revolution, and the output of our economy has increased 40-fold. We have overtaken such great industrial powers as Britain, France, and Germany, and now occupy the second place, second only to the United States. And now we are faced with the fundamental task of catching up with the advanced capitalist countries as far as production per capita is concerned. First of all, we consider that the conditions are ripe to solve the task of catching up with the United States in the production of milk and meat. As far as milk and butter are concerned, we will be catching up with the United States as far as production per capita is concerned, in the next year, 1958. This year, apparently, as far as the total output of milk and butter is concerned, we will be on the level with the United States. But since our population is greater than that of the United States, we require another year to catch up with the United States as far as the production per capita of the population is concerned. As far as meat is concerned, things are difficult, more difficult, true enough. Therefore, as far as the production of meat is concerned, we hope to catch up with the United States, say, in 1960 or 1961. I find it difficult to name the exact year, because the task will be solved not by me personally, but by our people, by our country as a whole. Our farmers, our agronomists, our zootechnicians, etc. And we are convinced that we will be able to solve that task approximately 1960 or 1961. Your specialists, who say that that is impossible, have allies among the ranks of our economists, too. Because some of our economists have been telling me that that task will only be solved in 1975. But we'll laugh at those prophets among our people as we will among your people.
Mr. Cutler?
Mr. Khrushchev, I too am interested in meat. I've heard experts say that no nation in the world has ever been able to increase its meat supply 3.5 times in 4 years. Do you communists have some way of seeing that every cow gives twins?
That is also possible in nature. Not only twins, but the triplets are possible in nature. But that is not our main hope. We believe that in trying to solve this task of increasing the production of meat, the main place will be occupied by the production of pork. Because here the possibilities are really tremendous. Also, the production of fowl, of poultry, is very great. The British, for instance, are like the bacon very much, and we don't see why the Ukrainians or the Russians should not like bacon too, as do the English. Another point I want to make about meat. Up to now, our cattle has been killed at the age of 1 year, usually. Now, we want to decrease the number of cattle killed, and then increase the number of cattle killed when they will reach 2 years, when they will be 2 years old. It's a very rich country. And I don't think that you should be sorry about it either, because we realize that you hold first place among all capitalist countries in all fields of production. But now there's a socialist country on hand which is trying to catch up with you, and you can be sure that we will catch up with you.
While we're on agriculture, Mr. Khrushchev, you had a bumper wheat crop last year. How do the prospects look to you for wheat this year?
That is an important point, an important question. Last year we had a very good harvest, but I must say that it was a good harvest only in Siberia and in Kazakhstan. The harvest in the Ukraine, which was formerly called the main grain-producing area in the Soviet Union, was very bad last year.
What you call a healthy attitude of competition among the peoples of both our countries. I would like to ask you, sir, going to another field now, in terms of the international relations between the USSR and the United States, particularly as they refer to conditions in Western Europe and in other parts of the world, what do you consider at this time to be the most pressing points that must be solved between the two countries?
I believe that the main thing is to normalize relations between our countries, between all the countries of the world, and first and foremost between the United States and the Soviet Union. This normalization, as I see it, should take place as follows. All restrictions on trade should be removed. We should begin with that. We should remove these restrictions, and you must do away with your iron curtain and not be afraid of Soviet cooks arriving in the United States. I don't think they will make any revolution in your country. Therefore, that is the first condition. Then there should be exchanges of cultural delegations. There must be more contacts between our peoples, between businessmen. That is the main thing, I should say. But at the same, at this time, at the present time, you are practicing discrimination. You will not, you would, you are not trading with us. Some of your political leaders believe that in so doing, they are doing damage to communism. But you must realize that does little damage to us. On the contrary, that compels us to make an extra effort and produce things at home which would otherwise have been bought from your country. And it will be the same in the future if things go on as they are. But these things create a tense atmosphere, create a lot of nervousness in the world, and make it possible to unbalanced people to speculate on war, to make warlike threats. That is dangerous because the people of the world want peace and want a normal life. That we, for our part, are trying to do all we can to bring about a normal state of things and to bring about peaceful coexistence between countries with different systems, that is to say, between capitalist countries and socialist countries.
Well, Mr. Khrushchev, can we assume from what you have just said, then, that you are prepared to allow Western diplomats more freedom of travel in your country? Can we assume that you will stop jamming broadcasts of the Voice of America? Can we assume that you will take some steps in opening up these contacts you speak of?
I think that as far as restrictions on travel of diplomatic personnel is concerned, I think that if there were a mutual agreement, we would be prepared to improve matters and to do away with these restrictions. These restrictions are elements which have been brought about as a result of the deterioration of relations between our two countries.
Would you say that they were part of your Iron Curtain, Mr. Khrushchev?
We reply to your Iron Curtain in kind, and sometimes we put up a sort of a wooden curtain. Then you asked me about the Voice of America.
Yes.
Our country is a very musical country, and you know we have many good singers, both in the past in Russia and now too. Therefore, if it's a good voice, we do not jam it. On the contrary, we want it to be heard all over the country. But if it's a voice which cuts on the ear, then every person switches off one's radio or jams that radio because that voice gets on one's nerves. Therefore, if the Voice of America does become the Voice of America, because we respect the American people, will not be jammed in our country. But when it is not the Voice of America, but a sort of wailing over the radio, supposedly the Voice of America, in that case, we want to avoid our people getting the wrong view of the American people.
Is there not a contradiction, Mr. Khrushchev, when you talk about competition economically, and yet you seem not to want to allow competition of ideas? You make the decision instead of allowing the people to decide what they will hear.
you see, to divide us from the people. That is an old tune, an old record, an old broken record, and no one is prepared to listen to that record anymore. We believe that there has and will never be another government in this country than the Soviet government, and no other party than the Communist Party, which reflects the desires and the wishes of the people so much. And as far as other countries are concerned, we have no ulterior motives, and therefore the policy that is being pursued by us is not really the policy of the Communist Party, it is the policy of the Soviet peoples, and the Communist Party is only the vanguard of those peoples. And now, is there any contradiction between our statements that we want to compete with you? We do want to compete with you, and in that competition we want to have the most healthy forces come into the forefront, and we believe that our socialist system represents the most healthy elements, because it is the youngest system, the most healthy system. And if you are acquainted with history and know how one social system was changed and another system took its place, you will know that the old capitalist system in our country has been replaced by the socialist system. And I can prophesy that your grandchildren in America will live under socialism. And please don't be afraid of that. Your grandchildren will not understand how their grandparents did not understand the progressive nature of a socialist society. As far as competition between capitalist and socialist ideologies is concerned, we have never made a secret of the fact that there will be an ideological struggle going on between these two ideologies. But we never believe that that is the same thing as a war, because this would be an ideological struggle in which the system, which will have the support of the people, that system will come out on top. At the present time, your American people do not support the Marxist-Leninist theories. They're following the bourgeois political leaders. But is that a reason for war? Is that a reason for any enmity between us and the United States? No, let us live in peace. Let us develop our economy. Let us compete. Let us trade with each other. Let us exchange experience in agricultural, in industry, in the field of culture. And as far as the question of which system will come out on top, let history, let our peoples decide that. I think that is a good way out. We believe that our socialist system will be victorious, but that does not mean under any conditions that we want to impose that system on anyone. We simply believe that the people of each country themselves will come to realize that that system is best for them. That is up to the people concerned to decide. We have no intention of imposing our ideas on anybody. That is what I have to say in reply to the
Mr.
question.
Mr. Khrushchev, to come back to your remark about not being divided, government and the people, it reminds me of a recent statement from Peking, which I believe was also published in Pravda, that in a socialist state there can exist contradictions between the masses and the leaders. I wonder if in republishing that in Pravda, whether the Soviet communists accept this idea, and what are the implications of it for the Soviet Union?
socialist or capitalist country has its own course of development and its own stages of development. And therefore, socialist countries, we, for instance, our country has been in existence 40 years, the Chinese People's Republic has been in existence 8 years. Therefore, a stage through which we passed is not, does not necessarily have to be repeated in other socialist countries. Then each people have their own habits, customs, history, its own history, and the Communist Party of the country concerned should take that into account, of course. And our Chinese friends have many original ideas which they are implementing in the course of socialist construction in their country. We believe that we have no contradiction of that nature.
You've received that underlies the policies of the Soviet Union.
That is not my view. I simply repeated what your political leaders have been saying, and your generals especially, your admirals. God knows how many speeches are being made in your country saying in how many hours the Soviet Union can be destroyed by the power of the United States. We don't indulge in any such things. Reproached with changing my mind in that once I said that in a new war capitalism would be destroyed. I can repeat that, but it would be a terrible war, and therefore what we want is to avoid a military conflict, but we want to to compete with capitalism by peaceful means, economically and otherwise. And as far as the United States is concerned, the people of America themselves will come to realize that capitalism is no good for them.
Mr. Khrushchev, you've just said that a future war would destroy capitalism. Is it your theory that a future war would not destroy communism also?
Would not. It would bring tremendous calamities to the whole of mankind, tremendous losses in life and material values, but still mankind would not be destroyed. And since mankind would continue to live, that means that the ideas of mankind would continue to live. And the immortal idea of mankind is that of communism. But that is a very high prize, a prize, and it would be a tremendous calamity both for capitalist and socialist countries. And therefore, we have to live on one planet. You prefer the capitalist system, we prefer the socialist system. We'll continue to have ideological differences, we'll continue to compete, but we must live on this one planet.
Speak of coexistence with a country if you really believe that this country is planning a war against the Soviet Union.
We would prefer that you would not plan that war against us, but you are, and we believe that you are planning that war. But you must know that such a war would be a very awful thing, and therefore those plans might not be implemented. Therefore, if there is coexistence, if you show a desire to live in peace with us, then we, as well as you, would be able to alleviate the burden of taxation. We would be able to switch our labor reserves from the production of things which do not go to the good of mankind. We want peace very much, and we want friendship with the American people. with friendship with Americans, not in order to have our two great powers combine against other countries, because we think that friendship between our two countries would go to the good of other countries. In that case, for instance, Luxembourg would hardly represent a threat to us. I like to be very emphatic about that, so that all this technical equipment of yours could translate it for your American people.
Can I ask you any hope for an agreement on the basis of the current American approach, a first small step?
I know not of the step that the United States is prepared to take, because Mr. Stassen has not yet put forth his proposal.
Position in discussing atomic tests and bombs is that all atomic and hydrogen explosions can be detected. If that's the Soviet position, then why is it that the Soviet government has not given notice or even announced afterward the last five tests conducted in this country?
Give to mankind nothing. What difference is there whether as long as there is an explosion, the air has been poisoned, the people of the world will not gain by anything if such registration is made beforehand. We prefer a more fundamental approach.
And that is the question of Western Europe.
A war might be imposed upon us. And if it is, our people will fight with even greater enthusiasm and a loyalty in defense of their country. But in order to prevent that, what steps should be taken? Why couldn't the United States and the other countries withdraw their troops from Western Germany, from the other countries of the West, from France, Italy, where else have you got troops? Turkey, Greece, perhaps? While we would withdraw our troops from Eastern Germany, from Warsaw, from Poland, that is to say, from Hungary, from Romania, we have no troops anywhere else. I think that would be very useful, a useful first step to test the goodwill of the two sides and to establish a good atmosphere which would not smell of war, but which would lead to good, friendly relations that could be brought about between our two countries. That is what we have been talking about, and we're quite prepared to do that.
Would that be included in an air inspection system to control the execution of such an agreement?
You see, that is a different matter. We would be withdrawing our troops from foreign territories. But at the same time, this inspection would be imposed upon foreign territories too.
Troops from Western Europe, you're talking about withdrawing over a period of 3,000 miles. When you speak of withdrawing Russian troops from East Germany, this is a matter of pulling back to 2 hours away. Now, as a realistic man, wouldn't you say that some kind of assurance of mutual trust might be forthcoming here?
Arithmetic is not quite correct. When you speak about the distance of withdrawal, I would say that your withdrawal will be less than ours, because Britain, for instance, is across the channel from the continent. The United States is across the ocean. Now, how long does a ship take from the United States to Germany or France? And at the same time, how long would a train troop go from, say, Irkutsk or Vladivostok in our country to Eastern Germany? And you will see that the distances are about the same. Therefore, not look upon each other as robbers. but we should look upon each other as honest people. We're prepared to give you our word, and we're prepared to afford the means of control. We're agreed to have control inspection posts established to check up on the agreement and
that those countries would all remain communist.
It's a fable. You are probably contaminated with this talk too. You seem to think that the communist system in some country can be held up by our armed forces, but I wouldn't defend a communist system of that kind. The communist system must be based on the will of the people, and if the people should not want that system, then that people should establish a different system, and for that reason we have no fear of withdrawing our troops from any country of Eastern Europe or from Eastern Germany, and we're certain that the people themselves will defend their system even better without that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Look how Chiang Kai-shek is holding the people of Taiwan in his hands. And look what the people of Taiwan have done when they don't like that regime.
You have raised America's troubles in Formosa, and this is a frank discussion. I only wanted to ask you, how long do you think the Kadar regime would last without Soviet troops and tanks in Hungary?
Let's have a test. Why don't you withdraw your troops from Germany and France, and we will withdraw ours from Germany, Poland, and Hungary, and you will see that the Kadar regime, which is the people's regime in Hungary, will flourish for ages to come. And where the working class has won power, it will not yield that power to the exploiters, but will rather develop their economy and their culture. That is what the Kadar regime is. It is not the Kadar regime, really, because Kadar is a servant of the Hungarian people.
Mr. Khrushchev, we don't have very much time left, and I would like to use some of the remaining time to ask you this question. What great step do you think now the Russian Soviet government is prepared to take in order to ease some of these tensions that we've been speaking about and in order to approach a better understanding among the countries of the world?
My view is, and I'm sure that we're constantly making those steps, but if one side makes a step and the other does not reciprocate in kind, there will not be any relaxation in tension, because this relaxation is not a one-way street. A reciprocal step is necessary on the part of the United States, Britain, and France, and we will not remain in debt in that case. Our most radical steps have been proposed. We have made proposals on disarmament. We suggest that restriction on trade be discarded. We suggest that the United States lower the Iron Curtain and start a widespread cultural exchange. I find it difficult to add anything else to that now. If the United States were to reciprocate in kind, we would have great progress.
Does the history of the last year since World War II indicate at all where the Soviet Union may have been at fault or may have made mistakes in international relations which have led to some of these tensions?
I don't know what mistakes you have in mind. I'm prepared to admit that both sides might have had a more reasonable approach. A desire on the part of the capitalist countries to test us. Because when your political leaders say the liberation of the so-called enslaved peoples, meaning the socialist countries in Europe, well, I don't want to argue about what you think slavery is, but I want to say that we look upon the capitalist society as slavery. And we think that the peoples living under a capitalist system are living under capitalist slavery. If we start arguing on this basis, the result will hardly be good.
I am sure that we are all in agreement that such an argument would produce not very much in terms of this discussion, but we are most grateful to you for your presence on Face the Nation. We wish to express our appreciation for the cooperation which we have had
from
your associates, and particularly I am grateful to your interpreters, Mr. Viktor Sukhadrev and Mr. Oleg Trojanovsky. Our thanks also.